We're in a discussion of John chapter 13, and we've been looking at the Passover, the week of the Passover, and the events helps tie the whole theme together of the book of John. We're very familiar with John 3:16. Jesus' reason for coming is salvation. And John 3:17, he didn't come to bring condemnation, but rather salvation. And so we see that this is called the thematic statement of the book of John. It's interesting that it's at the end of the book of John, one chapter left after this statement. As we're looking at John 13, we want to just briefly review, especially for any of our visitors, what we've covered at this point. Then we're going to look at the first five verses of John 13. Notice there are two Sabbaths that are mentioned in Scripture in the context of this Passover week. We're also going to notice there's going to be a third Sabbath within this Passover week, but it's not going to be stated as such, but we know that that occurred because of what we've found in our background in Exodus 12 and in Leviticus 23. Mark calls attention to the fact that the women get the spices and preparatory things for Jesus' burial after the Sabbath. And so what we have is that would have been the annual Sabbath, which we mentioned Nisan 15. Remember, the 14th of Nisan was the preparation day. The 15th is the first day of the feast. And according to our Hebrew background, we find in Exodus and Leviticus, then the first day and the last day, the seventh day of the Passover feast, which is also called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, were days in which you would do no customary work. They would be a holy convocation, each of those days. And so that's going to put it on the 15th and the 21st of Nisan, the first and the seventh, the last day of the feast. And notice then you have, just to go back over Mark 16:1, and when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, bought sweet spices that they might come and anoint him. Notice then you have Luke 23:55 and 56 telling us it was before the Sabbath, and now this is the weekly Sabbath, so that we can see that after the Sabbath, after the annual Sabbath, 15th of Nisan, but before the weekly Sabbath, which is going to fall on what we call Saturday, to our way of thinking, their seventh day. And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed after him, and they observed the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and fragrant oils, and they rested on the Sabbath according to the commandment. That's how we harmonize these two Sabbaths. And then on the 21st, which, you know, since Jesus is resurrected on the 18th of Nisan, the 21st, they would have another Sabbath, but it's not within this time frame of Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. So that weekly Sabbath then would have been Nisan the 17th, is what that would have fallen upon. Notice then we have the day before the Passover, just by way of review, Nisan the 14th, the preparation day, that he was crucified. That's when you would crucify the Paschal Lamb, the Passover Lamb. To our way of thinking, that's Tuesday sunset to Wednesday sunset. And then you have the feast begins, Nisan the 15th, the first day of the week. John 19:31, it's called a high day. Why? Because a holy convocation, it is one of the annual Sabbaths. Notice that's our Wednesday sunset to Thursday sunset. And so the first Sabbath that we are discussing within this time frame. Jesus here is in the tomb, the first night and the first day, as we count these 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth, as we found in Matthew chapter 12. Notice then the second day of the feast is Nisan the 16th, our Thursday sunset to Friday sunset. Second day, second day in the tomb. Then the third day of the feast, this is the weekly Sabbath, Nisan the 17th. Our Friday sunset to Saturday sunset now, we come to this second Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. Notice then you have the third night and the third day in the tomb, the second Sabbath. Then the first day of the week, Nisan the 18th, Saturday sunset. And of course it'll extend to Sunday sunset. And we're going to see that whole discussion on the road to Emmaus. Clopas is one of the ones that is mentioned of the disciples with whom Jesus has the discussion, Luke 24. And so you're going to have, this is on the first day of the week, they're talking to the resurrected Jesus, though they don't know until he reveals himself very clearly to them, because text, one of the interesting statements, their eyes were holding, some of your older translations. And so you have the first day of the week, our Saturday sunset, that third day we've talked a lot about, the third day, and the reason we've talked a lot about it is because 14 times when it's mentioned in Scripture, after about the third or fourth or fifth or sixth or seventh time, you start sitting up, and by the 14th time, it's like, you know what? If I haven't studied this before, maybe I need to get around to doing that. Some people talk about getting around to it, and you watch out for some of these older people that have secured some of those round to it. I was shown around to it whenever I said something about that one time, and he had gotten around to it, and it actually said to it on it, it was round. Well, that's what we need to do with this third day, because when I realize it's 14 times, this is something, anything that's mentioned in Scripture a dozen times, especially in connection with the death, the burial, the resurrection, on the third day he would rise, this is that important. So then the third Sabbath that is mentioned, it's not recorded in Scripture for us, but it is Nisan the 21st, the 21st of Nisan, last day of the feast. And no customary work, considered a rest. That's what Sabbath is a rest. So there are three, but Scripture covers for us these two. So we covered the third day. We won't go back over that in detail. Just to show you those 14 times, Jesus was raised the third day. Notice that both you have Matthew, you have Mark, Luke. Isn't it interesting that we don't have the third day stated as such early on in John, but you'll have this statement that we've covered that occurs on the road to Emmaus. Those disciples say, besides all these things, it is the third day since these things happened. And so you have Luke 24, but John is just not, he doesn't call attention to that third day is what I was trying to say. Luke 24, 21, again, speaking to the resurrected Jesus. Now they're talking to him within that time frame, Saturday sunset to Sunday sunset, Nisan the 18th, the third day. Today is the third day since these things happened, they state, Luke 24, 21. Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, as we count these days back from when they say third day, just by way of review, so we say third day, well then what's the second day? That has to be Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, Nisan the 17th, and then you would have Nisan the 16th, which would have been Thursday sunset to Friday sunset. And notice as we track as well, when they said the third day, he's resurrected. Well, the second day, that means he was the third day in the tomb. And then the first day since these things had happened had to be the second day in the tomb. So there's more than one way that we can harmonize and see the harmony of Matthew 12, verse 40, about the three days and the three nights in the heart of the earth. We can look at that not only with what we've studied from Exodus 12 and Leviticus 23, that they would actually kill the lamb, it was said, on the evening of Nisan, on Nisan the 14th, and then they would celebrate as a Passover beginning that evening, which then Leviticus gives us the clarification that then means that that's the 15th. So we can track all this down at least a couple of ways to see what is meant by the third day. Then we, of course, come back to John 13. And now let's read verses 1 through 5. because we've been talking about this Last Supper, and then, you know, who's going to wash their feet? Notice, begin with verse 1. Now before the feast of the Passover, which we also know as the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own, who were in the world, he loved them to the end. So he loved them to completion. This is the word that we'll have, telos. He loved them to the end, to the finality, to the goal. It's the terminus, it's the completion. He loved them. And you could actually argue, based upon the way this is used, he loved them up to the uttermost, completely, absolutely, thoroughly. So it does convey those concepts. Verse 2, and supper being ended, the devil having already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. And notice that we'll come back to this discussion about Judas Iscariot, who would betray him, because it's also mentioned a number of times. John is preparing us for what happens. Notice then, verse 3, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel, and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. So, we talked about one of the traditional views of this supper, which is simply not accurate. They did not sit at a table as we sit at, you know, to look at Leonardo da Vinci's painting. That's not the picture. This is far more accurate here. From everything we can tell, the seat of honor was this, what we call the second seat on the left, and you see Jesus on the second seat on the left. And this seems to be a pretty accurate depiction of Peter right here, because he had to lean over Jesus' bosom at his breast, his chest, and it does appear, we'll talk more about this in the context of John 13. It appears that Peter is actually going to be whispering, is what it looks like. And it looks like also the possibility that maybe Jesus doesn't speak out loud where everyone can hear, but he responds to Peter. Because John records, it's so interesting that John records something for us, a detail. Maybe it's, you consider it a minor detail, but you know, in some occasions, to try to really piece some of this together, you know, we usually try not to major in minors, but this is something that we minored in this minor detail, and we'll look more about this at this about Jesus' response to John. I'm sorry, that's not Peter. Peter's the one who asked the question. John's getting information. It's likely, as some say in this depiction, that this may have been Peter, because he motions over to John. He motions over to John, and John's the disciple whom Jesus loved, from all that we can tell. Now, there is a view that possibly it was Lazarus, but that's not how Lazarus is even referred to in Scripture. And it has to be that he's one of the 12, from all that we can assess. So John, if this is an accurate depiction, which appears to be, then it's likely that Peter motioning, gesturing, because he doesn't have Jesus' ear like John does, the disciple whom Jesus loved. We'll talk more about that as well. That's why we say this is far more accurate. We talked about, it looks like the sequence of events that, of course, we know there was an ongoing dispute among the disciples about who would be the greatest, and it appears that with what is stated, as we try to put the sequence of events, that in all likelihood they had this dispute prior to Jesus clothing himself with a cloth, taking off his outer garment, putting on a cloth to wash their feet. And notice, I just want to highlight something we covered prior to this, that Pickering tells us there was an ordinary meal, and that's why he talks about it being a better reading that supper being ended, so that it would be after supper. He says there was an ordinary meal and then the Passover ritual itself. He's saying that the ordinary meal was finished. The meal was basically over, but they couldn't proceed with the ritual because they were ceremonially unclean. Their feet hadn't been washed. They were dirty from the dust of the road. That would bring this into harmony. So then, first, this strife about who is the greatest appears to have occurred. And then you have this statement, the Passover, beginning with the washing of the feet. That brings us to the John 13, 1 through 17 passage we're looking at. Daniel B. Wallace says, as guests and family members entered the home to celebrate Passover, a servant or slave would often be there to wash their feet. This was the task of the lowest class of people. But it's clear nobody else is volunteering to do that. Jesus does. And that's why we have then, of course, picking up with verse 6, then he came to Simon Peter. Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Verse 7, Jesus answered and said to him, what I'm doing, you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Notice his refusal. Verse 8, Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no part with me. Well, instead of being excluded from Jesus and his kingdom, notice then Peter, notice what he says, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. So then you have Jesus tells him, verse 10, he who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean, but not all of you. We've talked about this concept of being cleansed and being clean has to be according to what we have later on, John 15:3, according to what Jesus says is the word. You are already clean because of the word which I've spoken to you. It's just not usual that Jesus would be really fixating and focusing upon physical cleansing. This is spiritual, a spiritual discussion he's having. So then, notice you have that they could eat the meal, the common meal, as they had already, but not the Passover. It was time to proceed with the ritual. But first, someone had to wash the feet. No one was offering. So finally, Jesus gets himself, he gets up. So that would make sense. The sequence of events is correct, and it makes sense how this proceeds. We've talked about the song that really fits this passage, Make Me a Servant. We talked about the original version of this by Jimmy and Carol Owens. And then where we had left off, with a newer version of this song by Tim Jennings and Matthew Basford. And once again, just to cover that first stanza, and we didn't get past the first stanza, but once again, notice, make me a servant just like your son. For he was a servant, please make me one. Make me a servant, do what you must do. To make me a servant, make me like you. We talked about Matthew 10, verse 24. A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a servant above his master. It is enough for a disciple that he be like his teacher, and a servant like his master. We talked about 1 Peter 2, 18, that Jesus is our example, based upon that context, verses 18 through 21, of submission. Since the statement of the servants or the slaves are mentioned, to be submissive. And you were called for this because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. Steps of submission and suffering. 1 Peter 2, 18 through 21. Notice the second stanza of this song, Make Me a Servant. Make me a servant, take all my pride, for I would be lowly, humble inside. Giving to others with all that I do, in love for my brother, make me like you. Notice we also see from this passage, as well as the song reflects, about Jesus, though he's the greatest of all, he is void of pride and arrogance, in every false way, you might say, to use the terminology of Proverbs. Also notice Proverbs 16, 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. Someone called Proverbs 16, 18, they summarized it by saying that pride is the prelude to destruction. And that's an apt description, I believe, of Proverbs 16, 18. So The way up is the way down, and yet, what are they seeking? They're seeking who's the greatest. Who's on this, you know, who is the greatest on the pedestal? And so Jesus really obliterates all of their thinking and shows them that if you really want to be great in God's kingdom and to God's way of thinking, then you become the greatest servant. You humble yourselves. And that's why we also include James 4, verse 10. Humility. If we do the lowering, God will do the lifting. And James 4, verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. And the opposite of that is true as well. If we do the exalting and we do the lifting, God will do the lowering. And notice, interestingly, I think we've called attention to this in the past. I really believe that when we look at what Peter says, Peter, of course, is who's going to remember what happens more than Peter in this whole scenario, especially since Jesus has this personal engagement with Peter. 1 Peter 5, 5 through 7, notice what Peter says, and it seems to be a very clear allusion. Very clear allusion to John 13. 1 Peter 5, 5 through 7, Peter says, "Likewise, you younger people, submit yourselves to your elders." This is a word for older ones. To your elders or your older ones. "Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility." And now notice that terminology, be clothed with humility. You talk about the perfect picture of being clothed with humility. John 13, Jesus is clothed with humility when He girded Himself with the cloth. And Peter states why. "For God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble." Other translations, "God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble." Notice verse 6, "Therefore humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that He may exalt you in due time." Because if we do the lifting and the exaltation of ourselves, then the mighty hand of God that could otherwise have lifted us up if we humbled ourselves, rather will deal us a crushing blow. Notice, I also included verse 7 in this, and the reason why is because, notice, we're very familiar with 1 Peter 5, verse 7, "Casting all your care or your anxieties upon Him, for He cares for you." And so when we really humble ourselves, we submit ourselves to God, then according to this context, doesn't it appear that we also let go of our cares? Because we may not think so, but a lot of our cares and our anxieties may have a lot to do with our pride and our refusal to be submissive to God. I find that to be very interesting within this context. So if we're worrying too much, we're anxious, then we may not recognize it, but, you know, and I would never have thought of this had it not been within this context, but God's way of thinking appears to tell us that if we are anxious, have a lot of anxiety, and a lot of cares, then it's because we're not being submissive enough, we don't have a humble enough of a mind frame, and otherwise, you know, we're holding on to it ourselves. That if we become devoid of self, we'll cast our cares upon God, we'll submit to God, we'll put it on God. And so 1 Peter 5 verse 7 certainly goes with this context. And at the same time then, Peter, you know, and it may be that based upon what he then says, 1 Peter 5, 8, "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour." Look what happened shortly after John 13. After John 13, you know, Peter said that he was ready to die for Jesus, and yet what did he do? He was not alert enough, sober. He wasn't alert enough. He wasn't vigilant, watchful enough. Jesus had even told him, you know, "Watch and pray lest you fall into temptation." And notice what happens. Peter does fall into temptation. And so it seems like to me that John 13 and then the events that happen afterward fit really well with what Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 5. Because then he stresses again, I mean, really in a way he's telling us to resist the devil by being sober and being vigilant. And he specifically says so in 1 Peter 5, 9, resist him, resist the devil, steadfast in the faith, firm in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. And so, this concept of humility. Then, we also see with the song, Love One Another, in love for my brother, make me like you. John 13, 34 and 35, just shortly after this context of washing one another's feet, but Jesus, had he not, by telling them that he had given them an example and that they should do so for one another, verse 15, I've given you an example that you should do as I have done to you, verse 15. Isn't that love? Notice then, John 13, 34 and 35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Whereas, you know, you can look at this concept of a new commandment in a number of ways. Some would say, well, it's a greater degree of love. You know, what we have under the old covenant is love your neighbor as yourself. So you love your neighbor as you love yourself. When Jesus says, as I have loved you, that you also love one another, that seems to be a higher level of love, does it not, than what we find in Leviticus 19:18? To love my neighbor as myself, well, Jesus, he actually loved them more, I think we could probably maintain, more than he loved himself. He was such a self-emptying love. And in verse 34, there's a lot of discussion if you look into this concept of a new commandment. So the magnitude and the degree, you might say, of love. Verse 35, by this all will know that you are my disciples. How? By the fact that we partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week in memory of Jesus, as he has told us. Well, that's not what Jesus says. Well, will everybody know by the fact that we do not use instrumental music in our singing? No, it's actually if you have love for one another. And that's why we then, of course, in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, we have so much stated about love, because that was the problem. Ultimately, it was a heart problem, a lack of love, spiritual heart problem. They couldn't get things right, because when they didn't really love each other as they should, then you have all this bickering and fighting and strife, 1 Corinthians 1. Similar, you might say, akin to what we have about the strife among the disciples. And if they really love each other as they're supposed to, they're not going to have this strife among themselves. And so you'll see, you can make a number of parallels with what you see at Corinth and their lack of love, and that the heart, the root of all their problems, with some of the same things that we're dealing with Jesus' 12 apostles. And of course, you know, it was so bad at Corinth that they were taking each other to court, which is prohibited to one who is following Christ, as you look at 1 Corinthians 6. Well, they actually, even if you look at 1 Corinthians 5, they were not wanting to discipline, withdraw from a very ungodly brother who had his father's wife. And so had all these issues, so much so that you even have even a misuse and abuse of the spiritual gifts, 1 Corinthians 12 and 1 Corinthians 14, in which we have the love chapter sandwiched between those two chapters in 1 Corinthians 13. So, loving one another. The third stanza of the song, Make Me a Servant, notice, make me a servant, filled by your might, and may all my labors shine with your light. Show me your footsteps and what I should do, for now and forever, make me like you. So when we're filled with God's might, notice just two verses on this. Ephesians 3, verse 16. One of the ways we might be able to remember this, since we can remember John 3:16, Ephesians 3:16, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might through his Spirit in the inner man. And verse 17, that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and length and depth and height, to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. And then we're probably familiar with Ephesians 6, verse 10, part of the panoply of God, the Greek word for whole armor, full armor of God, verse 10 of Ephesians 6. Finally, my brothers, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. So, to be filled by God's might, and to shine with God's light. We're familiar with Matthew 5, verse 16. Matthew 5, verse 16. Let your light shine in this way would probably be a better rendering. Let your light shine in this way before people that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Just as a city that is set on a hill, it cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand that it may give light to all in the house. So in this way, let your light shine before people that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. And then Philippians 2, verse 15. This is one of the verses that I think we would all do well to pay closer attention to. And the verse before it. Let's look at Philippians 2, 14 and 15. Do all things without complaining and disputing. Well, the apostles were not even immune from this concept of complaining and disputing about who would be greatest. Verse 15. That you may become blameless and harmless, innocent. Children of God without fault in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. He then says in verse 16, holding firmly the word of life, so that I may rejoice in the day of Christ, that I've not run in vain or labored in vain. So, we'll pick up from here back into John chapter 13. We're going to look at more of these details because there are quite a few details that we want to cover in the context of John chapter 13 that will hopefully help us to have a better understanding of these events and then application to our